I'm excited to have the BC Bureau Chief of the Rebel TV in the Toddcast studio. We've known each other for a while, Christopher Wilson in studio.
Todd, great to be with you.
Man, where do I start with you? Because, of course, you know, we follow each other online, social media and stuff. I love what you throw around. I love your views, your politics. I mean, it's fucking top notch.
Appreciate that. It's sometimes tough in this business when you're constantly a target from other media organizations and the haters, but it's good to hear that from someone who's, you know, just, I think it's safe to say you're just a sort of an outside viewer of the political scene. And
absolutely. Politically, I'm probably a one on a scale of 1 to 10. You know, I'm more of a music guy, yeah. Entertainment guy, sports yeah. guy, but that doesn't mean I don't follow politics. I just don't engage in it. Much.
There's so much crossover nowadays, though, too, right? I mean, it's just with what we've seen, and we can get right into this with Trump.
Oh, yeah. We're going through Trump, Trudeau, of course.
Kevin O'Leary.
Right.
You're seeing a lot of crossovers.
So to get this rolling, mm-hmm. what is your role as BC Bureau Chief for the Rebel TV?
Well, I'm a full-time employee, so I'm every day I'm putting out content. Usually, so 5 videos a week generally for the website, and you can find them on YouTube or on the rebel.media. And basically, I try to focus on not only BC issues, but issues that the mainstream media doesn't really want to use, doesn't take certain angles on or is being missed, or stuff that is a little bit more contrarian. And that's sort of a natural thing for me. That's sort of maybe what attracted me to the idea of coming to the Rebel and contributing on a site like that that's totally trying to turn the traditional mainstream media format upside down, taking advantage of declining interest in traditional media, media sources, and trying to bring views that don't necessarily come from a traditionally trained journalist. And for me, someone who went to college and studied business, I really like looking at it from economics first approach, and also looking at it from just someone who has who cares about looking at things critically from a different viewpoint than what a traditional journalist would do. So that's what I kind of do. I also like to go to protests. I used to do that on my own a lot, just even before I started the Rebel. So challenging protesters and maybe just trying to get reactions out of people that, you know, traditional media don't really want to do because they feel like it's not their role, per se.
And how do you find those stories that traditional, global or CTV or CBC or whatever, how are you finding these stories that they're not necessarily reporting on?
Well, I think it's just from watching so much news growing up that I've noticed that there seems to be a lot of monolithic coverage of every single story. I mean, you can look at anything that makes big news. The big three in Canada are going to cover it almost the same way, CBC, CTV, and Global.
And why is that? Why do they all cover it the same way?
I think it's just because that's how the journalists have been trained to do it, some of the major universities, and a combination of just the way that a lot of the political views of journalists tend to swing. And I wouldn't even guess the percentage of journalists who are liberal or conservative in this country, but I have to believe it's well in favor of people who lean to the left. That's for sure, at least amongst the everyday newsroom reporters who are supposed to remain objective, but I clearly don't believe they do.
Supposed to, yeah. I don't think they do either.
No, and I think you've seen a lot of that being broken down just by the sort of visceral reaction people are getting to someone like Donald Trump who completely just brings these sort of bleeding hearts to their knees, and in fact I think just makes them show their true colors even more obviously than they did before, where they sort of were able to kind of hide it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, Chris, if half of the American public that didn't vote, the 150 million people that didn't vote, if they were to vote, would we still have Donald Trump as the president, or do you think it would be even more of a victory for him?
That's such a tough question, because apathy is hard to read, because, yeah, you know, I have tons of friends that don't even care about politics, never vote. And if they did vote,
which
if I had
crazy.
A gun to their head, I would say half of them would vote liberal, half of them would probably vote conservative if they believe that was more of like a freedom side. And there's sort of this natural, I think, when even people aren't politically inclined, are they sort of more egalitarian or more libertarian? Or do they want personal freedom, or do they believe in the social collective sort of thing? And so that's sort of a simple question, I think, that splits people halfway that are apolitical. So mm-hmm. I'm not sure it would have changed anything. But I think if turnout was certainly better amongst certain voter bases that voter groups that Obama tapped into than Hillary probably could have won. But I think the apathy had a lot to do with people just not being interested in her at all, the way they were with Obama, who's an exciting, even someone who didn't really like him can say he's an exciting, captivating, engaging guy, knows how to speak, can keep everybody's attention, whereas Hillary Clinton clearly couldn't.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's going to seem like a loaded question, but how is Trump doing?
I think I'd give him a B so far. I think maybe it would be a B plus if he had got the healthcare stuff through. I think that's a bit of a loss for him, although he could still come back with something better or something. They could still get a deal done, I suppose. I think that it's too early to really give a full mark, because what I like about what he's done is he's just instilled a new confidence and especially investment in the country. You've seen a lot of jobs being announced, a lot of investment being announced by major corporations who are engaged by the CEO president, as I like to call him, who's the first sort of business person to take the helm in the United States in a long, long time. And I think that that's a great sign so far, and that's where I give him full marks. I think the other side is that he's been a little bit sloppy with, especially with the travel ban, and I think in some ways this healthcare rollout, where both him and Paul Ryan just simply tried to put this out there like it was a done deal and then bring the others along, and they never did, and so it kind of failed last week pretty spectacularly. Mm-hmm. So I'd give him a B, and I think that there's a lot of room to go up to higher marks, or should things continue to go poorly, but I think that that's part of just having a lot of people that have never been in government before, and there's always going to be growing pains.
Mm-hmm. And didn't it feel like when he originally said he was going to run, that it was like he was like half-assed in it, that he actually wasn't serious about running, and then it was like, holy fuck, I guess I maybe have a chance to win.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, like, I think at any stage when people put out feelers, and I think maybe there's a potential that that was there too, but I also think that deep down, Donald Trump is a person that wouldn't get into something like that if it meant that if he really didn't think he could win. His ego is so big, losing something like that and having to be known as someone who was a failed presidential candidate, especially someone who was so you know, vicious towards someone like President Obama, mm-hmm. I think that would have just, you know, crushed his ego. So I don't think he wasn't serious. I think he actually knew what he was doing. And I think just a lot of people who are maybe laymen didn't see it, because he was going with the complete opposite strategy to typical Republican presidents, who thought that it was best to still, you know, pander to your base, but, you know, it's a waste of time going to rural communities to try and get out the votes, because you have to do so much, or you have to go so many different places just to get a few votes. But Donald Trump had a strategy of appealing to people in places where politicians, Republican or Democrat, certainly not Democrat, would ever dream of going. And in the early parts of the primary, where it seemed disorganized, he was going to these small communities and giving speeches, and had like I think he only had one person working for his campaign for a long time, a woman named Hope Hicks. And then he eventually, as it started to gain momentum, he brought more people in. And he prides himself on running a lean operation at Trump Tower. And I think he did the same in the campaign. He wanted the edge of saying, I don't need to fundraise billions of dollars and super PAC money, because I'll fund it myself, or I will, you know, rely on a lean campaign that doesn't use a lot of big TV buys, because I'm going to reach people by Twitter, or I'm going to use, you know, all that free press that he got early on, especially.
Boy, he uses Twitter, hey?
Oh, yeah.
Is it weird, though, that he won, being that he was so misogynistic, he was so racist?
Well, those are the accusations, and I don't necessarily agree that he's a racist, or I think the things that he said that were misogynistic are things that could be accused of any sort of guy who kind of is a bit loose-lipped. And I think that the racism stuff, I think, is a little bit misguided, because I think that the accusations of racism are sort of convoluted in this sort of idea that somehow he's anti-immigrant, when really he's been talking about illegal immigrants. And even in that famous speech he gave the first day, when he said they're sending rapists, he's sort of, you know, people don't like when Trump supporters sort of try to, you know, see into his words, but you kind of have to, because he's so imprecise in his language, that he was referring to illegals that were coming. And, you know, we've just seen recently this terrible accusation in Maryland, where there was two illegal immigrants that potentially allegedly raped a 14-year-old girl in a high school bathroom. So I think bringing attention to something like that was such a key issue. And it was something that I think he learned from Ann Coulter, who wrote a book on it called Adios America. And he just stuck with that playbook. And it was the key, because he went an atypical path than a typical Republican would have. And I think any other Republican would have lost to Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. closer to home, Trudeau.
Yeah. So he rode a similar wave that a Barack Obama, I think, rode to office. But I think that he's going to find it difficult to find the same momentum the second time. Because I think there are people that feel let down by him, mm-hmm. especially on issues like electoral reform. A lot of people who traditionally vote NDP or Green probably said, okay, we'll throw this behind because then in future elections, when I vote Liberal or I vote NDP or Green, it'll mean more because they'll have more representation in Parliament. The other one I think locally that he's going to have a hard time dealing with is the approval of the pipeline. Mm-hmm. A lot of the base of votes he got, I think, were anti-pipeline people that thought he was going to nix it. And that's not the case.
No. Same thing for the marijuana.
Yeah, that's a really interesting one. I think I did a piece that I said he's going to screw it up bigly, to steal a line from Donald Trump.
Bigly, yes.
Yeah. I just don't think that the format he has for it is friendly to business, friendly to entrepreneurship, or to the people that actually know what they're doing in that industry at this point, even if they are technically doing it illegally. And I think he wants to destroy this natural organic industry that's grown in places like Vancouver, where we see dispensaries everywhere, and in Toronto, which are getting raided. And I think he's going to crack down on that. I want to have a very crony corporate system. And that's why you see people like Marc Embry even endorsing Maxime Bernier, a libertarian leading conservative, rather than someone like Justin Trudeau.
And your thoughts on Kevin O'Leary?
Well,
is he the Canadian Trudeau, like, or Trump rather?
Some ways he is, because he's bold enough and just says whatever he wants sometimes and isn't afraid to speak in sharp rhetoric about some people. And I like that about him, because I think that in some ways, you know, you have to be a bit of a jerk in politics. But I don't think he's completely Trump as far as the ego and necessarily the outlandishness. But I think there is some elements of his appeal as a business person, as a non-politician, that I love, is that I think that he's not going to be looking to help out all his friends or close conservative allies or things like that, that political people, even within the conservative or liberal ranks, doesn't matter, love to, you know, dip into the trough when they get into government. I think he wants to make it run lean like a business, and I'd like to see him be the guy who could bring transformative change to the way we look at economic opportunity in Canada, because right now, the path we're on, I really fear we're heading back to a time where, you know, all the opportunity is going to be somewhere else, and it's going to be too expanded. I think even in the new part of that is the affordability crisis in Canada. We may not be able to do much to stop the housing crisis, but we certainly can do something about trying to make sure people can have a chance, if they really want to work their ass off, to have a great chance to have a good job and have an economy that's growing so they can keep getting raises. Mm-hmm. I think that's such a key.
Does O'Leary have does he stand a chance to be the Prime Minister of Canada?
Well, I think he certainly stands a chance of winning the Conservative leadership race, I think. I think that's down to about four people now, with Bernier, Scheer, and then maybe Kelly Leach, but I think she's kind of written herself off a little bit. But I think he has a stand a chance to win that. Now the question is, and this is where I've sort of been frustrated with him, is he hasn't come out and fully said what his plans are. Will he run in a by-election right away and come into Parliament? Will he give up? If he wins this Conservative, will he immediately quit doing what he does day-to-day with all his other businesses and all his other TV work and work as a full-time leader of the Conservative Party of Canada? And he needs to answer that question, because if it's a no, I'm less likely to think that he would be the right person. But if it's a yes and he'll run in a by-election and get into the House of Commons, then absolutely, because he has the celebrity status that a lot of people liked about Trudeau and could still give Trudeau some buoyancy at the polls. Mm-hmm. And I hate to be cynical, but especially from women.
That's exactly right. Well, let's get a little bit past politics
sure.
and stuff.
Yeah,
I want to get into entertainment. I want to get some sports and stuff with you
stuff
as well.
Too, so I sometimes get sick of talking politics all day. So.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so hit me with what you thought was the best movie of 2016.
Oh, you know what? Though I hate to do this to you, Tom. I'm not a movie guy, but I'll do TV shows, but movies not so much.
So you didn't watch Deadpool? You didn't see Batman?
I saw Deadpool, and I saw
Deadpool was so good, man.
It was
such a great
show. It was great. And, you know, it's finally an action movie that was rated 18A or R in the States, right? And, you know, so often, or superhero movies, right? So often they're sort of PG'd down. And
that kind of sets the bar, I think.
And Ryan Reynolds was just so brilliant in that.
He's amazing. He's from Vancouver, filmed on the Georgia Viaduct and all that.
Very recognizable, yeah.
But I think that kind of set the bar in terms of, like, DC looking and going, holy crap, like, we better step up. And I think that this next Justice League movie is going to be amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. I think the Wonder Woman movie is going to be amazing.
I've heard great things about Logan as well, just recently out. And so
I haven't seen that, but
yeah, I mean, I just not, you know, sports violent. Take up most of my time, unfortunately. Not so much movies, but and TV shows, because I'm such a binge watcher now.
All right, so what hit us then? What are you watching? What are you binge watching?
What am I watching right now? Well, certainly Homeland, because of the sort of natural political angle to a show like Homeland. Love that. I've been watching Billions. It's another Showtime show. Really been liking the intrigue there.
That's funny. That's both the same actor.
Yes, it is. What's his name?
A guy crush on him, or what's going on? I can't remember what the guy's name is. Red-haired dude. Yeah, great actor.
Great actor. And of course, Ballers, when it's out in the sun with The Rock's football, basically the pro sports version of Entourage, which is sort of my favorite TV show of all time. And I'll rewatch episodes of Entourage anytime.
They release that movie, Entourage movie?
Yeah, they did. It was
How was it? I didn't see it.
I saw that. It was safe.
The actual series was amazing. You would think that they would transfer that to the big screen.
It was like everything you predicted the movie was going to be. Like, Vince gets a chance to make a big movie, and Ari's going to give him the chance. And, of course, they think it's going to suck. But then, at the end of the day, it doesn't suck.
Right.
And everybody lives happily ever after. Thing. It's very safe.
Medellin.
Well, it definitely was not Medellin. That was... Right. And unfortunately, the show Entourage sort of lost its way the last couple of years. A lot of people sort of felt that way. I've rewatched a lot of it. I kind of like the last couple of seasons that have the sort of unique part to it. But, you know, you can't really talk about the first five seasons of Entourage. I mean, that's sort of an all-time legendary. Yeah. And for sort of that generation of sort of kids that were growing up in the sort of mid-2000s and graduating around that time, it was just such a dream situation.
Totally.
You want to live that life, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Sports, of course, you're a Vancouver Canucks fan. Yeah. Do you go deeper than Canucks? Are you the Lions? Are you go CFL?
Lions. NFL? I mean, I love all sports. I follow all sports, basically. I mean, my family is from South Africa as well, so I watch rugby and cricket and all that sort of stuff sometimes too. But yeah, the Lions, I'm a big CFL fan. I like to back the CFL just because it's a little bit of a sort of an issue of patriotism. And, you know, it's our league, it's our sport, and it's sort of a thing that is sort of unique to Canada. We do things a little bit differently in that.
Which is better, CFL or NFL?
Well, as far as entertainment value and like drama and like production value, I think you can't deny the NFL. But if you want to go to a game, even as someone that you could go down to a Seahawks game, but I mean, a CFL is a very reasonable price, and you can get in the door.
It's like $20.
Yeah, you can get in the door for, I think, $30 at a Lions game now. And the only sport I don't really follow too closely is soccer. A bit of a North American purist on that. I just find it such a sort of a slow sport. But baseball is a huge thing for me. I played it a lot growing up. Blue Jays all day.
How about the Jays last season?
Unbelievable.
Shitting the bed.ca. How did that happen? That was their year. They should have won.
You think so? I mean, I thought 2 years ago they were actually a better team, but when they just seemed unstoppable in the second half of the season. But, you know, it had been like, so I started watching Blue Jays when I was 10 years old in 1996.
I was just going to say, how old were you for the whole Joe Carter?
I was remembering. I remember being Kelly Gruber, people say, but I didn't watch the team. I didn't know anybody. I was seven. And so it was, you know, but when I was 10, I started watching Blue Jays. 1996, I remember Pat Henkin winning the Cy Young. And then the next couple of years, Roger Clemens was on the team. They had Jose Canseco hitting home runs when he was juicing. So it was a exciting, you know, era, but they never made the playoffs. And then it was just years on years of just sucking and having, you know, a couple guys like Roy Halladay around and a few others that were worth watching every once in a while. So after sort of 20 seasons of them not doing a single thing and then finally making the playoffs 2 years ago, going on a run to the ALCS both years, it's exciting. And I think that they're a team that shouldn't be messed with this year either, because the young pitching staff is coming. And they've, even though they lost Encarnacion, they kept Bautista and were able to add Kendrys Morales. And I think that's a wash. I mean, Encarnacion probably a little better than Morales, but I think that you'll still see a team that competes and makes the playoffs, if not wins the division. Mm. And I think baseball, one of the best things I love to do is go down to Seattle every year when the Blue Jays are there, because it's an invasion of Canadians. Yeah. Last year was unbelievable, and the year before that was incredible too. And I think that it's sort of one of those, now it's kind of become like a yearly tradition for people all across Western Canada. You see people there from Saskatchewan, and they're not even wearing Jay stuff, they're wearing Rough Rider stuff.
Totally right.
And the whole downtown of Seattle, people are just going nuts because it's just all Canadians everywhere, drunk all day, all weekend in Seattle. So I'll be down there again this year, June 9th.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And what happened with the Vancouver Canucks this year? What happened to those guys?
It's been a tough couple years. The Sedins are just not the players they once were, and I think that that's what it comes down to. You don't, you know, they're playing top line minutes, but they're not producing like their top line players. And then the margin of error when you don't have a great team, you have to stay 100% healthy all year, and they just did not do that at all. And so you saw them sort of flirting with the playoffs around the All-Star break. They were sort of what, 4 or 5 points back. They put together a run, maybe they get there, but too many injuries, too many AHL call-ups. It's like watching the Utica Comets, frankly, right now. Yeah. There, no doubt, no joke, because right. It's like the, you know, third and fourth line are just full of call-ups or your season signings and some prospects too. The Besser, we saw him make the debut, the first round pick from a couple years ago to North Dakota, scored against Minnesota on the weekend. So There's hope because they have some young talent, but I still think next year will be another year they miss the playoffs again, sadly.
Another build year.
Yeah, another build year. Maybe competitive, but and maybe give flashes of brilliance, be a bit more exciting with some of the young players. I think there's a lot to build on there, but I think that, you know, I don't know.
So do they throw the last few games of the year to get a better
That's what every fan wants, right?
I mean, of course. You can't do that.
But no professional is going to do that. I mean, there's no integrity in doing that. I mean, you could, you know, I mean, if you, the management could say scratch it. I mean, they're already playing a bunch of call-ups, like I said, and you could play the backup goalie, but I mean,
right.
Bachman's playing well right now. Yeah, so.
They're already doing enough to shit the bed on their own. Yeah,
and so hopefully they win the lottery. I mean, that's kind of what you got to hope because, you know, this Nolan Patrick, I believe his name is, this should be the consensus number one pick. So if they grab him, he may not be a Matthews or McDavid, but you know, maybe a Nathan McKinnon, Jack Eichel, something like that, something to build around, another solid forward to add to the mix of Horvat, Besser, Granlund, who scored 19 goals this year with wrist problems, playing with it all year. So tough Finnish players, love that.
Yes. Oh, I wanted to talk about, did you hear that Sweden has transferred over to 6-hour workdays?
Work, you know what? That is...
And they're saying that there's more productivity from their workers.
Well, I mean, sure. You can maybe they don't, maybe people are able to work harder for those 6 hours and not slack off. But I you know, I think it's some one thing that I admire about the United States is it's the most productive country in the world and people work hard there with the actually... Overtime is sort of one of those things that is sort of admired as you just do down there. Whereas these sort of more social democratic nations, it's all about sort of, you know, how can we make your life easier? And I mean, if I had to work 6 hours a week, I'd be annoyed. I mean, I live in Vancouver. We live in Vancouver. I want to work two jobs because I need to work two jobs to survive here. So. Right. You know, and I would want to work more anyway, just because for me to ambition and trying to get ahead and earn more and become more successful is something that I just, you know, is a driving thing in my life personally. I mean, and I know that's not for everyone, but you know, that just strikes me as sort of like one of these sort of very far left ideologies that, you know, if we work less, we'll actually do more.
Well, that's what they're saying. Yeah. And they're like, you know, and we also, when you have a kid, when you have a baby, we'll give you, you know, 2 years of time off. And, you know,
well, I know. And I read a article out of Australia the other day that suggested that it might, we need to actually force, you know, new mothers back to work because it's a productivity loss. And I, you know, I'm not really one to weigh in on all that. I think you have to give some benefits to that sort of stuff, but you know, never having raised a family myself or really had two, I mean, I've had a few close friends who've been able to.
I thought you were going to say I had a few close calls. No,
not yet. Not that I know of anyway. I mean, I usually play that one pretty safe, but
you know, a couple buddies though that have
I've had a couple buddies who've had some had kids and they have young families and they've been able to both some of them have had their wives or girlfriends take time off, some of them have personally taken time off and they've made it work. I'm just not a huge, like I said, I'm just not a huge fan of people working less. I think that productivity and ambition and you know, seeking to be the best employee you can, no matter what your job is, something that everybody should aspire to do. And, you know, 8 hours is, you know, sometimes it's long for some people. 6 hours, okay, well, maybe you can meet in the middle and make it 7.
But you're not talking like the extremes that you see in Japan where they work themselves to suicide.
Japan is such a, and that comes from more than just the culture of business there. It comes from a whole, you know, and I would never pretend to truly understand it, but I have been to Japan. And one of my good friends worked in Japan as a chef, and there is a strangeness to the way that the men in Japan just strain themselves. They'll work all day and not sleep at night. And just stay up doing that their own thing late tonight and then go get like 4 hours sleep and go back to work the next day. And I don't know if it's because of the sort of culture of honor in that in the Japanese culture, or just sort of like the way that that culture has evolved as more isolated over time. But that is something that's a little bit beyond my sort of.
I don't get much more than 4 hours myself.
Yeah, I mean, well,
myself to death here.
A lot of guys when they get old. I mean, I found it right away. Like about halfway through my 20s, I was able to just start sleeping like 5-6 hours a night. Right. That was something that when I was a teenager or in college was just like the
would have killed you. Like, I'm done.
Yeah, but yeah, you look at someone like Trump, 70 years old, seems to have a ton of energy. Never smokes, never drinks, has never done drugs. Doesn't necessarily have the greatest diet though, and yet 4 hours sleep, and he was doing. You saw how many campaign rallies he was doing there at the end, and so. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, you know, sleep is necessarily the key to productivity, but I don't think that telling people that they can have a 6-hour day is necessarily going to mean that the 2 hours that they would usually slack off is all of a sudden going to be productive.
Right.
It's just going to mean they're going to be working a 4-hour day.
Yeah. Have you ever had a near-death experience?
Personally, no. But my biggest fear is falling to my death. For sure.
Falling to your death.
Yeah, I mean, that's just sort of a recurring dream I've had my whole life, a nightmare that's the way I sort of die, somehow falling to my death and then waking up. But so, yeah, so definitely, you know, certain things that involve uncontrollable heights, jumping off high cliffs, definitely not something I like.
So you're not bungee jumping anytime soon?
I'm not a cliff diver.
Soon.
I grew up on the North Shore, and a lot of my friends love to go to like Lynn Canyon and stuff and cliff dive, and I was like, none of that. No, yeah. I need to be
skydiving, not happening.
Skydiving is not happening. I was just in Vegas for a bachelor party a couple weeks ago. They tried to get me jump off the stratosphere. I was like, no, not my thing.
How are you for planes? Are you okay in planes?
Planes, I'm not so bad on because just I'm able to rationalize like, you know, the statistics about what is more dangerous.
Safer than driving in a car.
Safer than driving to the airport, yeah.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. Last question. Hit us with just an average day for you. Again, we'll bring it back. We'll bookend it here with the Revel TV. What is an average day for you?
So an average day, just sort of get up, scan. We got a really great guy back in Ontario who's already, you know, because I'm waking up a little bit later, he's hitting all the media. So there's a big scan that comes in the morning, and I'm sort of able to go through the stories and see if there's, you know, political events out here that I might need to, you know, attend if a cabinet minister is in or something like that. And then I sort of already got an idea from the night before of what my story is going to be. Usually, you know, find some angle that's going to be sort of that works for me, bang out a script. You know, my videos go from anywhere from 2 to sort of 5, 6, 7 minutes.
Mm-hmm,
That would be a typical day.
How long would it take for you to, like an average story?
Mm-hmm.
You're 15, 20 minutes, half hour, hour. How long does it take for you to
write? Well, I think I definitely a bit longer than that. So like usually the day before I've kind of got an idea. And I mean, sometimes stuff breaks in the morning that you want to kind of follow up on.
Right.
But yeah, so sometimes you can formulate something pretty quick, but sometimes, you know, it's a good couple hours. You want to make sure you research things, especially if you're talking, you know, just as a journalist, if you're talking about someone, you want to give them a chance to respond. You want to be fair. I mean, we're no different. I mean, people might think that Rebel's a bit of a firebrand news source, but I mean, for personally, I'm not going to, you know, go out there and make allegations against someone without a chance to get them to respond. So sometimes, you know, you got to make sure you're letting people know you're going to, you know, put something out there.
Mm-hmm.
But
how long will you give them? Like, hey, look, I need you to call me by this
time.
Yeah,
like a standard sort of, I like to give people at least 6 to 12 hours. I usually try to do that the night before.
Right.
If I've been to a protest over the weekend or something like that, yeah, a typical day is sifting through a lot of the coverage, finding the best clips, you know, in any media business, there's a lot of stuff that just gets, you know, doesn't get used. So you got to find the best nuggets and also kind of stream it together and find out how I can make my arguments while using the reactions from the people that I've interviewed and discuss why I think they're wrong generally.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I love it, man.
Yeah.
Last question, sure. I guess. How are you not verified?
Oh, you
how
know
is
what?
That happen? Like, how are, like, yeah, seriously, how you are know, you not I'm verified? Not,
you know, I know that some people, like, I mean, I love Twitter. Don't get me wrong. I love it. I just don't necessarily think that journalists, I think journalists use it too much and think it's more important than it is. I don't know if that you can quote me on this, but don't quote me as accurate on this because I heard this somewhere else. But someone said 100% of journalists are on Twitter, but only 15% of news readers use Twitter for that purpose.
Oh, no shit.
So I think that there's a lot, especially when you get into like the sort of like establishment, Ottawa, Toronto, Montreal corridor, and to a lesser extent to some of the people out here in Vancouver, though it's much not even close, and in the United States, the sort of DC Beltway corridor, where all these journalists think they're very important because they work for very large news organizations, and they rely on the reactions of other journalists on Twitter to verify all their sort of beliefs and claims, and then they sort of just pick off the sort of people that disagree with them and make a big deal out of it, but they're really not reaching the typical consumer of their either their website or their TV show or their TV station or their publication. Because I really believe that most people that consume news aren't the super partisan. Maybe it's different for a partisan network like Rebel, and I think that's certainly probably more of our viewers are on Twitter. But I think for typical mainstream journalists, that a lot of their consumers, they don't care what's going on Twitter. So I actually try to stay off the sort of arguing side of Twitter as much, although sometimes, you know, you feel it's
worth it. You do not. What are you talking
well,
about?
I mean, I don't try to get into long, intense, like, you know, back and forth with people and every person that says something negative about me to call them out.
Right.
But as far as the verification thing is, I don't really care. I think it's a badge of sort of like stupidity of, or not really stupidity, but a badge of like, of someone sort of, you know, it's virtuously like, look, I'm verified. I'm so much cooler than everybody else. And the second thing is, I think now you actually have to apply yourself.
Oh, you do.
I think you have to apply yourself. I have never done it. I'm sort of doing it.
No, same.
I just don't care. I don't know if they would actually verify me. Twitter might hate Rebel because we're contrarian conservatives. We don't know. There are people at our network who have been verified though, but there are also people like Ezra Levant, who's my boss, who's clearly a public figure, and everybody in Canadian politics knows who he is.
Sure.
Our network account got verified, but, you know, I just haven't really cared that much about it. I mean, it's a social status symbol that I could do without, I guess.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to start a petition to get you verified.
Are you verified?
No, because I also haven't.
Well, there
applied,
you go. So. Yeah. Well, see, why don't we part of the non-verified club, yes. The counterculture, right?
The non-verified club.
That's
yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Follow Christopher Wilson of the Rebel TV BC bureau chief on Twitter at @VanCity_Chris. @VanCity_Chris. Chris, thanks for coming in, man.
Todd, thanks a lot for having me, man.
You bet.
Really appreciate it.
Stick around for more beers, more Red Truck beers.
You know it, man.